Welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning local news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, positive cases of the coronavirus continue to surge in Utah as officials grapple with a response. And the science is clear, face coverings help prevent the spread of the virus, so why were health leaders wishy-washy about recommending them at the beginning? Also, protests continue nightly at the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office over the death of Bernardo Palacios Carbajal, and a look at who's funding Utah's four Republican candidates for governor, as well as where the race stands now. Joining me on the phone for this conversation, we have Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jessica Miller. Good morning and welcome to you, Jessica.
Good morning.
Good morning. Reporter Bethany Rogers is also with us. Hello and welcome to you, Bethany.
Thank you.
And news columnist Robert Gerke. Robert, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And a little bit later, we will hear from reporter Andy Larson as well. And listeners, you can join in with your questions and comments by tweeting to us today. Our handle is at KCPW. We are unable to accept phone calls today, but again, the handle on Twitter, at KCPW. Let's start with coronavirus. Yesterday, Utah saw its second highest single-day increase in coronavirus cases since the pandemic began. Thursday's numbers from the Utah Department of Health include 590 new COVID-19 cases. Utah's previous record high was set on Saturday with 643 new cases. Over the past week, Utah has averaged 503 cases per day. That's the data. And then what Utah is doing about it, what the policy decisions should or could be, the debate over that was another part of this story. There was a memo from Dr. Angela Dunn, the state epidemiologist, that said that if Utah didn't get to 200 cases per day by July 1st, and again, we're at more than 500 cases per day right now, but that if Utah didn't get to 200 cases a day by the end of this month, Utah Governor Gary Herbert ought to consider tightening restrictions in the state. And I have been on the receiving end of a number of statements from the governor's office. The gist of those statements is that we are not going to shut down the economy. And then another part of this policy debate has to do with mask wearing. Andy Larson and I, a little bit later in the show, are going to have a discussion about what drives behavioral changes in populations, how to get people to wear masks, and why it's not as widespread as health experts want it to be. But Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune, with all of what I've just said in mind, Utah's ongoing spike in cases, you know, what's going wrong here in the state?
Yeah, I mean, I think you laid it out pretty well. About a week and a half ago, a little bit more, I wrote a piece that said that Utah's at a tipping point. We had a lot of the cases were trending upwards after we went from orange to yellow across most of the state, some of the states in green. And it was alarming because, you know, there were more people out there who were infected. Right now there's, I think, close to 8,000 active cases. Those are people who've been infected and not haven't been classified as recovered. So there's a lot more people who can spread it, and there's a lot more people interacting because of loosened restrictions. And too many people are not interacting with the precautions in place, the social distancing and the masks. And so we've seen this big uptick. We've also seen big outbreaks in you know, manufacturing and food processing facilities. Workplaces are a hot spot. And so the numbers are trending upwards. It's not surprising that they are trending upwards. I think Dr. Dunn said when they loosened restrictions, they did expect an increase in cases, and the models all predicted that. But the increase has been a lot larger than people expected, a lot more rapid. And now we are on a trajectory that if we continue on it, we'll, according to Dr. Dunn and others, we'll reach our maximum capacity in intensive care units. And that gets into some real problems because then you have to start rationing care. You have to start deciding who gets it and who doesn't. And so, you know, there's been some pressure on the governor, considerable pressure on the governor to reimpose some restrictions. As you mentioned, Salt Lake County, Salt Lake City asked the governor and Summit County asked the governor to allow them to mandate people wear masks. And you know, that's considered to be a step that would help stop the spread, as you and Andy are going to discuss later. But it also, you know, it also comes with some political risk for the governor and some political blowback from people who think that if this is a choice, you know, they don't necessarily believe that there's viral spread out there, or that the virus is not dangerous to them, and that they shouldn't have to wear masks. Businesses shouldn't be required to require customers to wear masks. And so it's turned into this really political hot point or flashpoint, I guess. And last night, for example, there was a rally about 100 people up at the Capitol, you know, insisting that this is a infringement on their constitutional rights. I think, by and large, most people are not quite as strident about it. But there's also a large segment of the population that's not doing it. Businesses have always had the right to require it. People wear masks. You know, places like Costco, Whole Foods, whatever, have required people to wear masks when they come in. But a lot of businesses are unwilling to do that because they're afraid they're going to lose customers, and they're already struggling right now. So it's a fairly tenuous time right now. I think it. You know, you mentioned Dr. Dunn's statement, we need to get to 200 cases by July 1st. We're not going to get there. They're on the trajectory we're on. I mean, chances are today when they release the numbers and tomorrow when they release the numbers, we'll probably set new records. And considering the growth we've had over the past week, if we see that continue, we could reach 800 cases by the end of the week. Per day,
which is a very sobering thought. You know, you did write also. I mean, you're right that Andy Larson and I talk about the sort of what's driving people's decision not to wear masks, and in some instances, it's this erosion of trust in you know, conventional institutions, science, public health. And you can listen to that at the end of the show. But, you know, you wrote this column also about the mandate, the idea of mandating mask wearing in Utah. And you wrote that that Governor Herbert earlier this week said that a mandate would, quote, create divisive enforcement issues at a time when we need to come together of our own accord around a shared concern for one another's health, unquote. And this is, I think, the governor kind of hinting at the idea. This is something else that he mentioned, that there's resistance in Utah to the quote unquote heavy hand of the government, which is something else that he mentioned. So, Gerke, what should the state leader, what should Governor Gary Herbert be doing when it comes to mask wearing and having people wear masks? I know that there's another part of the story, which is that Salt Lake County and Summit County, as you just described, requested a variance to be able to require people to wear masks in businesses, and that's been granted by the governor. Is that enough?
Well, I think the governor is not wrong when he says that, you know, one would think that we would all do this voluntarily because we recognize it's a minor inconvenience, a small sacrifice that, you know, my mask helps you, your mask helps me. And so it would be something that logically and maybe from a, you know, compassion for our fellow man standpoint, you would hope that people would do it voluntarily. But the fact of the matter is that people were not doing it voluntarily. And so that's why the county, those two counties you mentioned in Salt Lake City are going to mandate that. The details of that are going to be available today, as I understand it.
Yeah.
But it's going to apply, generally speaking, to public gatherings, workplaces, and so forth, businesses. You know, I talked to the president of Utah Retailers Association, and he says he supports this because it's hard for businesses to do this on their own. As I mentioned, they're worried about losing customers, and you know, this gives them a little bit of cover, basically saying, well, the governor says we have to have these, you know, you have to wear a mask, so wear a mask.
Right.
The problem they're going to run into, and this is a legitimate problem, is how do you enforce this? Are you going to have police officers out there ticketing people? And they said they're planning to make it an infraction. I believe that's Summit County's plan. I assume Salt Lake would be the same thing. But a lot of this is going to be sort of soft enforcement, I think. People, businesses are going to be telling people that they need to wear them. You know, there'll be reminders, I think, more than people be. It's not going to be, you know, large-scale arrests of people who aren't wearing masks. I don't think anybody envisions that. These masks have been scientifically shown, and I'm sure you and Andy are going to talk about the data that shows how effective these are. And so the hope is that by getting widespread use of masks in public places, you can cut down on this, what's called community spread, which is just when the virus is out there running around. Right now, we've got, you know, identified places where people contract the disease, often at home, at work. But if when you're just out in the public and you start having cases, that's a real worry because that means you've got the virus is out there generally, and it's a lot harder to prevent. So that's the goal, the details of it, I guess, will be worked out. But yeah, there are people who are going to be really upset about this, and there's going to be blowback, and the governor's going to take some heat for it. Maybe politics isn't the forefront of his mind, but there is a Republican primary that's Tuesday, and his favored candidate, Spencer Cox, is leading the coronavirus task force, which, while it hasn't met recently, it puts him in a bit of a uncomfortable position. So there's perhaps some consideration there that he's, that there's concern that this might have some impact on the gubernatorial primary.
Sure. We will get to the gubernatorial primary a little bit later in the show. You talked about the blowback to the governor, but he is sort of, providing himself some cover as well by making, by granting requests from other jurisdictions as opposed to making this statewide. And he says that he favors getting, requests from counties and that he's a local control guy. Robert Kirky, we should probably move on to other news. You are a news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune, and thank you for talking to us about this. And, you get to opine freely, and we're going to try and sober up the conversation a little bit here as we turn to Tribune reporter Jessica Miller. But first, we will remind listeners to join this conversation by tweeting to us. We're actually not taking phone calls, but tweet to the handle at KCPW. And Jessica Miller, let's bring you into the conversation now, and we're going to change topics altogether. You have been covering something that we've discussed a little bit on the show before. We discussed it last week, in fact, protests over the police shooting death of Bernardo Palacios Carbajal. For 8 days straight, they have been protesting. The first question I want to ask, actually, Jessica, is this an extension of the protests that erupted in the wake of the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, or something altogether different?
The protesters that are protesting now, they did start with larger protests that have been going on. So sometimes they merge together. Sometimes it's the same protest. Sometimes people are up at the Capitol, protesting larger police brutality while this group is down at the DA's office. It kind of just depends on the day and what's been happening. But we've kind of seen this shift lately where most of the local protests have focused specifically on this case in particular.
Palacios Carbajal was shot 20 times as he fled from police. I guess 20 shots were fired, we should say. There's body cam footage from the shooting that is difficult to watch. And I think that for those listeners who can stomach it, and I don't want anyone to be exposed to this kind of violence, but watching this footage will allow you to understand this better than I think we will be able to describe it. And you can find it at the Salt Lake Tribune's YouTube page in its video upload section. And a warning that it's graphic. But with all of that said, Jessica Miller, can you tell us what that footage shows?
So the police were called to this area on a report that there was someone who'd just been threatened by a gun, and they had encountered Bernardo in a parking lot. They didn't really have much of a conversation. They just told him to show his hands, and he started running. And the police officers follow him for a couple of blocks. They're chasing after him. He stumbles a couple of times and seems to be picking up something off the ground. And then at a certain point, they start firing their weapon at him as he's still trying to run away. He did have a gun with him. He had never, from what we can tell from the body cam video, he never pointed at the officers and seemed to be just running away from them during this period. So what the video shows is most of the shots that were fired were shot at him while he was running from them.
Jessica, in previous incidences where officers who discharged their weapon, who shot somebody on the job and who weren't charged for that, it was often that the person they shot was sort of turning towards the officers, and the DA, in this instance, District Attorney Sim Gill, said that they therefore had a reasonable fear that that person was turning to use a gun on them. In this instance, as you said, you see Palacios Carbajal, you see that he's running with his back turned when he gets shot. I guess, the question I have here, Jessica, is what is the legal threshold for when an officer is justified in shooting someone here in Salt Lake County?
So the law says that an officer can legally shoot at someone or kill someone if they have a reasonable belief that they have to do so to prevent death or serious bodily injury to themselves or somebody else in the area. So that's the standard that Stengill will be looking at, is whether it was reasonable for these officers to fear that their lives were in danger or that somebody else's life was in danger.
Hmm. And then so Stengill has to make a determination as to whether somebody running with a gun is basically fits that legal definition of fear that could happen. I was going to ask you, Jessica, if that fits the legal definition, but that's obviously not a determination for you to make.
That's not my job.
That's not your job. That's out of your hands. As I said, though, we had 8 days straight of protests, and you were there this week, to witness this protest. What is the protest like? What is the message the protesters are trying to convey?
I think every day's been a little bit different, and they did protest last night as well. So they've been going for 9 days straight now. Some days it's a smaller group. Some days it's really large. There was one day a couple of days ago where the group was small, but the police, kind of interacted with them, made them stay on the sidewalk or threatened to arrest them. And so given that kind of tension, the next day the crowds were much bigger. The night that I went, there was probably about 400 people there. They plastered the district attorney's office with protest signs, and then they go march around the block and block traffic and chant there for a couple hours or a couple of minutes and then move on. So every day is a little bit different, but the common theme is they've been going every single day, and they've been pasting their protest signs all over the district attorney's office, sometimes at the public safety building, the police station, and they're asking for the district attorney to file homicide charges in the case.
And they're going to keep showing up until Stengill makes a determination of some sort, and possibly, depending upon what that determination is afterwards. What do we know when that will be, Jessica, when that determination will come down?
Yeah, I spoke with him earlier this week, and he told me that he is expecting to make his decision by the end of next week and will likely make that decision public the week after. So it's actually a very quick review compared to recent history, to what's been done in the past. It would be about half the average time that he's been taking in the last decade when he's interviewing these cases.
Okay. I think I'm going to bring the news columnist back in on this, Robert Gerke. And Robert, this is a very specific incident. There have been others here. Actually, I truly don't know what to ask you. I think I'll leave it up to you. If you have something to say,
here are my thoughts on this. I get that the public is upset now and police brutality is at the top of everyone's mind. It's a very, sensitive, topic right now. I am a little bit concerned that by expediting a review and by that the public pressure that's on the process right now may not lend itself to a just outcome, if that makes sense. I'm not a fan of a lot of the decisions Sim has made on whether or not to charge police in the past. I think he's generally speaking been pretty gone easy on cops in the past. But regardless of how this decision comes down, it's going to be viewed with some questions about the fairness of the process, about whether the pressure from the public has influenced the decision making. And so it's not an ideal scenario for any part of it, I don't think, to be saying, that in this pressure cooker, the DA is deciding whether or not police acted appropriately, and so it's not ideal. I do think that it's important that it gets a thorough and fair review, and regardless how the decision comes down, there's going to be some people who are unhappy about it. And so it's almost a no-win situation for the DA.
Jessica Miller, reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. Again, the background here is the national conversation and the local push to reform the police or to change the model of public safety and response. And again, that has been the focus of protests, aside from this very specific protest. Just on that topic, you cover justice and you've been doing that for quite a while now for the Salt Lake Tribune. Do you see things changing in a more substantial way than in the past?
I mean, I think it remains to be seen. We've seen some reforms already taking place, you know, with Representative Hollins having her bill passed that banned police using chokeholds. But interesting, I mean, here you look at our data of when police are using deadly force, and it's not often, it's not chokeholds, it's not like hand-to-hand combat. It's mostly police shootings, a handful of people who have died after being pepper sprayed or tasered. And so some you know, activists say that that's really where we should be focusing on, less on chokeholds and more on these other uses of deadly force, because those are the kind of cases that we have in Utah. Those are the deaths that we're seeing here. So it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds, if that's something that will be addressed in the future.
Jessica, thank you for bringing us up to speed on this. And we are just about to head to a break, but is there any piece of the story that we're missing that you want to add?
No, I think we're good.
Okay. All right. Jessica Miller is a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. And I'm sure that we will be talking about this again in the near future, and particularly when that decision from the DA comes out. As I said, we need to head to a quick break, and then we will turn to the Utah governor's race. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Jessica Miller and Bethany Rogers, and news columnist Robert Gerke. It is our Friday morning local news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by tweeting to us. Our handle is @KCPW. Bethany Rogers, to you now. You have been covering the governor's race, and this week you wrote about the financial picture in the Republican primary. That election is on Tuesday, and actually, before we turn to the money behind the candidates, let's talk about a new poll, which basically shows a dead heat between two leading candidates. Can you tell us about that, Bethany?
Sure. So this is a poll that came out last night. It was by the Salt Lake Chamber. And as you said, it has Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox and Governor John Huntsman basically dead even. They have Spencer Cox at 30% and John Huntsman at 29%, which is within the poll's margin of error. The poll was it was interesting. They decided to look at people who have cast votes and people who had yet to cast a vote. And Spencer Cox did appear to have a pretty, a healthier margin ahead among people who have already voted. He was at about 35%, where Huntsman was 30% among people who had already voted. However, Huntsman was a little bit ahead among people who said that they hadn't yet voted but were planning on it.
Okay. So in terms of actual votes in, according to this poll, Cox may have a little bit of a benefit there. I think so many people listening are wary of polls, and I am going to, you know, count myself among them. So just quickly, Bethany, I'm going to put you on hold and bring in Robert Gerke, news columnist. What this poll shows, Robert, is you know, whether or not we trust polls is kind of what you would expect, right, in terms of the two candidates leading?
Yeah, I mean, even the pollster that did the chamber poll included a little bit of a disclaimer that said, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of people who haven't made up their mind yet. There are a lot of people who say they are going to register as Republicans, but maybe haven't yet, but intend to. And whether they do or not is anyone's guess. I take especially polling a primary, even in optimal conditions, is really difficult. When you've got four candidates in the race, it makes it even harder. When you've got a large number of people who are registering as Republicans for the first time, whether they were Democrats or unaffiliated before, to try to influence the outcome, it makes it even harder because you don't know how many of those people are going to even vote. You don't know what the electorate's going to look like. And so all of these polls, to sort of go back to the point you made, are a little bit suspect. And I wouldn't put too much stock in any of them right now. They do seem to show that this is a race right now between Spencer Cox and John Huntsman, with Greg Hughes a little bit behind. And the Hughes campaign disputes that. They say that they're in the mix. This is a three-way race, and it's going to come right down to the wire. So I think there's a possibility that that's true. And the big uncertainty, I think, is who's going to turn out and vote, how many of these crossover voters are going to make are going to actually vote, and is it going to be enough to make a difference? And if a lot of them do come out, it could potentially help John Huntsman. But it's got to be a large, large number, an unprecedented number. Crossover votes almost never make a difference in any election in history. This could be a rare instance where there are enough that it does. So it's going to be a fascinating race, and we won't. I predict that we won't know the outcome on election night. It's not unusual now with mail-in voting that we are counting votes for a week or 2 weeks before we get a winner. So I think it's going to be. I think that's where this race stands. It's going to be a barn burner.
Bethany Rogers, Robert Gricke there talked about crossover voters, and some people listening might be wondering what we're talking about. There's a lot of Democrats and unaffiliated voters who joined the ranks of the Republican Party to participate in this Republican primary. Among them, Robert Gricke, the columnist. But Bethany, how significant are those numbers? How many people actually did that? Do we know?
We do. I wrote an article about this right in line with the deadline, which was June 19th for the switch. Now, unaffiliated voters are still able to vote in the Republican primary if they use one of the drive-up voting locations. They can affiliate there and get their Republican ballot. It's impossible to say for sure how many party switches have happened ahead of this primary, but the numbers show that the Utah Republican Party has gained upwards of 100,000 new active voters this year alone. It's not clear how many of those are directly because of people who used to be something else who switched over to Republican and how much are just newly registered voters. But I will say that in recent weeks, while the number of Republicans has gone way up, the number of Democrats, active Democrats, and unaffiliated voters has been dropping. By the number of unaffiliated voters dropped by more than 20,000, so pretty substantially.
That is pretty substantial. You said 100,000 new, more than 100,000, yeah, 103,000 new active voters since the end of last year.
Since the end of last year, and more than 44,000 just this month.
And these are, you know, Democrats and independents, and they are basically going into the GOP. And are they, I mean, Robert Gricke mentioned John Huntsman, but are all of these, do we have a sense that all of these people are lining up behind one candidate or another?
I think that, from what I've heard, the goal is to sort of keep the more conservative-leaning candidates like Greg Hughes and Thomas Wright out. That's been more the push than necessarily focusing on Huntsman. A lot of the voters that I've talked to who have made the switch support either Huntsman or Cox.
Okay. So, you know what, let's bring Robert Gricke just in for one more second, who is a Rhino columnist, Republican in name only. Are you and your ilk going to be a factor? I mean, how big of a factor do you expect to play in this election, Robert? I mean, you said that it's hard to determine because you don't know who's going to vote.
Yeah. I mean, this has been a strategy of the Huntsman campaign to try to get people to register. And as Bethany noted, there's also a group of people who are registering to try to keep Greg Hughes and Thomas Wright from winning the primary. It's hard to know if it's going to be a factor, but if the race is as close as this Salt Lake Chamber poll says, you know, if it is 1 point or if it's 4 points, which is sort of the average of the previous four polls, it's possible that big turnout, and we're talking in the order of about 70,000 people, which is about what the numbers indicate have registered. Those are obviously, as Bethany noted, not all crossover voters, but that could start making a difference. That could make it's hard to say right now. The turnout has been robust. There's over 200,000 people who have already voted. I think some close to 220,000 people who have already voted. And to put that into perspective, the last two primary elections in 2016 and 2012, those are the year that are statewide gubernatorial primaries, there were about 250,000 total who voted. So we're going to blow that out of the water and probably get close to 400,000 people. And it's going to be so. Yes, I think that the crossover voters in a close election have the potential to make a difference.
Okay.
And it comes down to how many there are and how they break. And right now, Huntsman is got a decided edge in among the crossover voters, according to the polls. And so any number that come out for him is a benefit to him. The question is just, will it be enough?
Will it be enough? I want to turn to the financial picture, but first I will offer the obligatory disclaimer that that John Huntsman is the brother of Paul Huntsman, who is the chairman of the Salt Lake Tribune's nonprofit board. Bethany, let's turn now to the financial picture in this race. There is some big money involved. How much money overall is being spent in this Republican primary?
So the campaign finance reports that just came out show that the candidates have spent about $6.5 million altogether on their primary. Many of them, Spencer Cox has spent more than $2 million. John Huntsman has spent nearly $2 million. The other candidates have spent closer to $1 million, but a lot all around.
Right. You wrote two articles about the financial picture. One of them is about the sort of larger checks coming in to support candidates, meaning larger single source contributors, individuals, or maybe organizations or businesses. Who are the big backers of these candidates?
So the biggest backer would be Representative Mike Schultz, who has given $440,000 to Greg Hughes for his candidacy. But he's definitely not the only one. Former House Majority Leader Kevin Garn also contributed $275,000 to the campaign of Greg Hughes. Thomas Wright is getting a lot of help from his brother-in-law, the businessman Fred Lampropoulos, who gave him $230,000. John Huntsman got a boost from his family. His mother gave him $300,000. So those are a few of the biggest contributors in the race. So far, some of the candidates have also lent themselves a lot of money. Thomas Wright has given himself a $300,000 loan, and Greg Hughes has given himself nearly $360,000 of his own money.
Hey, Bethany, just talking about those individual contributors, $440,000, $300,000, $230,000, $275,000, that's a lot of money. And I think some listeners might think, hey, aren't there caps on how much a person can give to any individual candidate?
No. Nope, the answer is no. In Utah, people, contributors can give as much as they want. There are no caps.
Okay. we're running low on time here, and so I want to kind of get through a number of stories. You also wrote this week, Bethany, about just this morning, actually, about so-called dark money groups that are trying to influence the race for Utah's governor. Who are we talking about with dark money groups?
So there are two political action committees that I'm aware of that have been paying for campaign materials, flyers in the governor's race. That are funded by dark money groups, and that means that they're receiving all of their support from 501c4 nonprofit groups, which don't have to report their contributors. So you have these political action committees who say, I'm getting all my funds from this one nonprofit, and then the trail kind of goes cold at the nonprofit, and you can't really tell who's fueling the nonprofit.
So could you conceivably, found a nonprofit one day and then the next day put all of your money in it and then the next day give all of your money to one candidate to hide who you're giving that money to? I mean, is it that easy?
I mean, essentially, there's not an easy way of knowing and there's no official way disclosure mechanism to allow people to figure out, how that money, where that money is coming from.
Just because we're low on time, Robert Gerke, influence of money in politics, single source contributors, also this dark money. Do you want to give us a hot take on all of that?
Well, $6 million is probably a little bit less than I expected these four candidates to raise and spend. But yeah, I think you raised some good points about campaign caps or something that's been debated a long time in the state, never gotten traction. If you can imagine how different this race would be if there were campaign caps. And I think, Bethany, correct me if I'm wrong, but Spencer Cox's campaign is the one who has done more grassroots fundraising.
Yes.
You can see where it would make it hard for a candidate who isn't, you know, either connected to a very wealthy donor or who doesn't have wealth of their own to compete in this field. And so it does close the door for a lot of people. The dark money issue is one that is really hard to get your hands around, and it goes against all of the, I think, generally agreed upon concepts of campaign funding, and that is that there should be at least be transparency in where the money is coming from. It's hard for voters, it's impossible for voters to know who's backing a candidate if we have these dark money groups spending heavily in a race. And so it's we have tried in the state in the past. Greg Hughes actually sponsored legislation to try to force disclosure by dark money groups. And that bill was struck down by the courts as being unconstitutional because it infringed on their free speech rights. And so the dark money thing is a big problem. It's not surprising that there is dark money in the race. But I think it's unfortunate, and I think it leaves voters at a real disadvantage when they're deciding on who they want to support because they don't know who's supporting the candidates.
Right. We have to turn here in a moment to our underplayed stories of the week to basically save time for a conversation that we have with Andy Larson coming up. But Bethany Rogers, any predictions about this race? I'm kidding. Robert Gerke, any predictions about this race? Utah by five, what's going to happen?
Actually,
right now, you know what? I can imagine that you feel conflicted about making any prediction, but go ahead.
I think Cox is probably the front runner right now. But again, that wild card out there, we don't know what the crossover is going to look like. And as I mentioned, it's a very, very close race. And that crossover, if it's huge, could overwhelm Cox. But I think right now he would be my favorite to pull this thing off.
Okay. Well, again, as I said, we need to save time for a recorded segment about why it's been hard to get compliance on mask wearing. And so let's turn to our final segment of the show. We'll have to make it quick this time around, but our underplayed stories of the week. Jessica Miller, we've been keeping you quiet since the last break. What's your pick for underplayed story? And again, if you can do it quickly.
Yeah, my pick for underplayed story is how coronavirus, as the cases have been rising across the state, it's now starting to creep into Utah's prisons and jails. There's been an outbreak down in Washington County where there's been 15 inmates, so that's something that we'll be watching fairly closely.
Thank you very much, Jessica, for that pick, and we look forward to the story. Robert Gerke, underplayed story.
Well, we talked a lot about the governor's race. The attorney general's race is actually a really interesting one this time around. David Leavitt, Mike Leavitt's brother, who's the Utah County attorney, is challenging Sean Reyes, who's the current attorney general. It's been a heated, very pointed contest, but it's one that maybe hasn't got all the attention it deserves. So you can go to sltrip.com and see some of the coverage there. They had a really great debate that the Utah Debate Commission sponsored that really showed the stark contrast between these two, and it's something the voters should know about when they cast their ballots.
Okay. Great pick from Robert Gerke. Bethany Rogers, underplayed story of the week.
So just staying with the election theme, I have a story from my colleague Lee Davidson, who wrote about how campaign signs on highway overpasses actually violate Utah law, which I did not know.
All right. Three great picks from our excellent guests who've been joining us this hour, and we will say goodbye to them now. Bethany Rogers, Jessica Miller, and Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining me on Behind the Headlines today.
Thanks, Roger.
Thanks.
And for the remainder of the show now, we are going to turn to Salt Lake Tribune sports reporter turned science columnist Andy Larson. And this week, a look at the difficulties in getting people to comply with voluntary mask wearing measures. Take a listen. Andy Larson, thanks very much again for joining us today.
Yeah, again, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Mask wearing. Why aren't folks wearing masks? And what are the sort of cultural forces and political forces at play? That was a question that you dug into for your column this week. First off, Andy, do we have any data on attitudes about mask wearing, or is there any data on compliance with the practice, either locally or across the country?
Yeah, I mean, there have been a lot of surveys done of people in America over the last month or so, and the most recent one I could find was taken from early to mid-June. It was a Pew Research report that said 65% of people reported wearing a mask when they're in businesses all or most of the time. And then they were asked how often people in their community wear masks, and they reported 44% of the time. Now, either there's a sampling issue there, or people are either lying about what they're doing or are misunderstanding what other people are doing. But that's right. That's about what we're talking about, is somewhere around half, maybe a little bit less, maybe a little bit more.
And then the reason for why people aren't, because that's a big number, you know, whether or not it's just a little bit more or not, why people aren't doing it. A lot of people are blaming the kind of pseudoscience crowd, the anti-vaxxers, people who disregard eschew rigorous peer-reviewed academic science. And there's some of that for sure going on, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, there was a survey done at the beginning of the year in January that basically asked people, hey, do you believe that vaccines work? Do you believe that vaccines are good? You know, or are you an anti-vaxxer? And 84% of people said, yes, vaccines are helpful and not harmful. We actually had 9% of people say that they were actively harmful and 7% of people who weren't sure. You know, that's really the size of the American anti-vax movement is, you know, at most 20%. And so that leaves a lot of questions of like, okay, what's up with the other 30% of people then that aren't wearing masks right now?
Just to stick with sort of pseudoscience for a little bit longer, there's this quote unquote study about garlic and coronavirus. Can you tell us about that? That's sort of a bizarre turn in your story, and I think it's indicative of, you know, more of that kind of anti-science crowd. But go ahead and explain that to us.
Yeah, it's something that I've wanted to get to for a while, and now I finally found an excuse to write about it. But in March, there was this study done basically to figure out whether or not the garlic essential oil could somehow dock to the cells in your lungs that the coronavirus docks to, and therefore prevent the virus from happening in your body somehow, I guess. And like,
yeah, I mean, you said study, but is it? I mean, okay, go on, keep going.
It's not even a study. It's a computer simulation of like the individual carbon compounds in each of the two, in the virus and in garlic and in this lung receptor, and it's like, all right, like it's pseudoscience, right? It's like someone was paid to do this garlic essential oil study and find a good result. And this was the only way. Yes, one carbon compound can conceivably connect to another one. But like, what does that even mean? It's one of those like weird, it's total pseudoscience and like the very worst of kind of what paying for science can get you.
Well, and you on that topic, and we don't have to linger here, but you wrote about a best-selling book on so-called alternative medicine, a book that did a lot of harm when it comes to trust in medicine and science. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that Kevin Trudeau book, Natural Cures They Don't Want You to Know About, and they as in scare quotes even on the title, which I love. But it was a best-selling book in 2005, sold only second to Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. So to give you an idea, it was number one on the self-help New York Times bestseller list. And it's full of all these like quack medical statements like antiperspirants and deodorants contain chemicals and you shouldn't wear them, and you should immediately stop taking any drugs you're taking, prescription, certainly never take a vaccine. It said AIDS was one of the greatest hoaxes ever perpetrated on the American public. Stuff like that where it's actively harmful to the medical community. And yet this was a number one bestseller. You know, it was actually on my family's bookshelf growing up. I remember that. And so it kind of gives you an idea of like how much kind of the medical community has to deal with this quack science and where some of the problems can come from in terms of adoption of really well understood stuff like, you know, a mask.
Yeah. I mean, we could go into a different realm here about why people want to glom onto conspiracy theories or stories that everything's being hidden from you. But I guess that's a topic for another conversation altogether. Just quickly, though, Trudeau, the author of this book, he's in jail, right?
He is in jail. He's currently serving a 10-year jail sentence, which was the result of him not paying the settlement. And he actually had a settlement for another book that he had that said, you will not do any more infomercials about this book. And then he continued to show 32,000 more infomercials after that. And that gets you sent to jail for a while.
Well, that's what they want you to believe about why he got sent to jail, Andy.
Hey, yes, in square quotes.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so you write that, again, that pseudoscience, that, you know, the anti-vaccine people isn't the whole story when it comes to why right now during this pandemic people aren't wearing masks. And that early on, in fact, it wasn't exactly the recommendation that the scientific community was putting out there, which has been difficult to surmount. Why wasn't the scientific community recommending mask wearing early on? And you know, give us some examples of how that was happening.
Yeah, you know, I think there's this big swath of America that basically is like, you know, I will do an inconvenient thing if I'm very convinced that it's the right thing to do. But when you have inconsistent messaging, it becomes harder to get those people to do that thing. So in our case, you know, the World Health Organization and the CDC didn't recommend mask wearing until late March or April, even. April 4th, I believe, was the date of their initial guidance on that. And before that, people like Dr. Anthony Fauci came out and said, hey, you don't need to wear a mask on the street. You know, everyday people don't need this, whereas it is helping healthcare professionals.
Save it for the medical.
Yeah, and you know, that was clearly some of the rationale, was like, hey, save it, you know, we have a limited supply of these, save these for the healthcare professionals. But even if you go back to earlier pandemics and smaller epidemics where supplies weren't an issue, they still didn't recommend mask wearing. And I think it's interesting that, you know, it wasn't just a shortage, it was actually there was this lack of medical consistency in terms of, You had China and these Asian countries that were very pro mask wearing, and then you kind of had the West that just said, hey, we don't have enough research on it. We don't have these randomized controlled trials that are kind of the gold standard in scientific research. And so we have all of this actually really good evidence about mask wearing, but none of it is of the type where you randomly put two people into a group, mask wearers and not mask wearers, and expose them to a pandemic and see what happens. And so I think what occurred was in lacking this kind of gold standard evidence, and instead of having all this other evidence, they held out too long for the very best possible research. And as a result, kind of were very wishy-washy with their mask recommendations at the beginning of the pandemic.
But we do know now that there is a benefit to wearing masks, right, Andy?
Yeah, we do have a lot of really good research now, and, you know, especially in the last couple of months, there's been a lot of good work done. You know, we know that the virus particles are filtered to some extent, even by the lowest quality of cloth masks, you know, even the one layer, you know, tea towel kind of masks do relatively well compared to not having anything at all. Just like the paper blue surgical masks do really well blocking, you know, somewhere between like 80 to 90% of viruses. So we've got research there. And then we've got all this research that basically is observational research that says, hey, in all these countries and all these states that we are implementing mask mandates or there is high mask adoption, we see the effective contagion rate significantly lower than in the places where there isn't mask adoption.
Right. Okay. So that's a message that obviously public health officials, governments want to get out there. But is messaging alone enough to convince people? I mean, some of this might be cultural, right, Andy? I mean, there are people who adhere to rugged American individualism and the idea that the government isn't to be trusted, isn't going to tell me what to do. I'm thinking here of a quote by Phil Lyman, former San Juan County Commissioner and now a state lawmaker, who said that, you know, if the governor tells me I have to wear a mask, I'm absolutely not going to do it. You know,
in fact, he said the opposite. If he said, right, if the governor told me not to wear a mask, then he would.
Right. Which so, is just, I mean, right. So is it about, I mean, there's another, yet again, another conversation we could be having about science and maybe the privatization of science versus government sponsored research, which allows it to be independent. Man, I'm going down a tangent here. But Andy, what about, is it enough? Is putting the message out there that, hey, this is effective enough?
That's been kind of some of the latest research is trying to figure out how much of people's behaviors change based on governmental mandates and versus based on just what they think is the best thing to do, based on other messaging, based on what they're hearing in the news from their friends, et cetera. That's still coming in, to be honest, because we don't have a lot of places to compare where there just weren't early mask mandates in a lot of places. the early evidence says that governmental mandates really do help adoption for whatever reason. And that's even more so than like governmental mandates of social distancing did not help to a great degree. So, you know, I think that's really interesting, the potential of a mandate in terms of really raising that adoption an extra step. Some of the most interesting research I've seen has actually been on other kinds of safety measures we've taken. So not masks, but seatbelts or smoking in restaurants and those kinds of things. And in those cases, governmental mandates and having the threat of like a police officer pulling you over because you weren't wearing a seatbelt really did raise adoption in significant ways.
But in terms of, yeah, so okay, but relying on the on voluntary compliance from people, especially in a moment in time where we've seen an erosion in trust in conventional institutions, even science and public health, things that, institutions that almost everybody thought were invulnerable to that kind of erosion of trust are now seeing it. Can we rely on voluntary compliance?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know, right? you certainly hope so from a public health point of view. But the truth is that every 10% more mask wearing means some X number of reduction in our effective contagion rate, our RT, so to speak. So what I keep looking at is Utah's contagion rate, our RT is right now 1.15. So if we were to reduce transmission by 20%, that's really what it would take to get the disease really going back down again. And mask wearing, if we see a 40% increase in mask wearing, that seems like that will basically do the job. we can get halfway there if we go halfway on the mask wearing and increase it in other ways if we want to do that. But that means closing businesses and putting further restrictions on our economy. So in terms of kind of what the lowest cost way is to reduce this thing, it's widespread mask wearing. And that's why so many people are asking for it to be mandated.
Andy Larson is a sports reporter turned scientific columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. As always, it's really a pleasure to have this conversation with you. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks again.
And you can find all of Andy's explainers about the coronavirus, and he's been doing quite a few of them at sltrib.com. And we have reached the end of the show. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines, a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Jesse Ellis is our operations director. Thanks again, Jesse, and to Utah Public Radio's team in Logan. Thanks for sending us around the state. I'm Roger McDonough. Join us again next week. And I just want to know the same thing. I want to know how's it going.